Hi, you're listening to Conversations here on WDRT. My name is Joe Orso. I'm your host today here with my friend Frankie Voltz. Frankie Voltz, Francesca Voltz. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Yeah, so I'm going to tell a little bit to start just how we met before we met. And then we're going to hear a poem, and then we're going to chat. So I actually knew of you just because Adrienne was doing, my wife was doing a farmer's market stand some years ago. And there was this person there who had a typewriter and was making poems on the fly for people. And it was always fascinating to me, but I guess I was never brave enough to go inquire myself. But a mutual friend of ours, Zara, one year for my birthday, did ask you to write me a poem. I guess she told you some things about Adrienne in my life and what I was doing, building a house, and you wrote this poem, and it was a really special poem to me and to Adrienne, and we kept it. And some years later, Adrienne pulled it out again and framed it and put it on a shelf in our house. And then, like, a couple of months later or something, we started working at Small Family Farm together. And as we chatted, I was like, oh, I have a poem from you that my wife just framed in our house. And then we've worked in the fields together at the farm and had a lot of great chats. So I thought we could start by you just reading that poem, which is kind of about home.
Yeah, and I wish I could remember more of, one thing that's really cool about writing those poems on the fly is that people share so much with me. And what ends up in the poem is sometimes just a few little pieces. And I wish I could remember at this moment so I could say more about what Zara had shared with me. But it was such a sweet way to get to learn a little bit about you and some life work that you were doing in the form of building and... just so cool to be able to meet you before I met you. And the title is called There is a Certain Beauty in Reassembling Your Own Old House. May it stand solid for 100 more years. Because, well, before I read the poem, maybe you can explain. You were rebuilding a log cabin?
Yeah.
Question mark?
Yeah. So... my parents had moved up here a couple years before. So this poem is from 2018, 5 years ago. My parents had moved up here a couple of years before then. My wife and I and our daughter at the time, now we have a son too, pulled our tiny house onto the land so we could live on land with my folks. And then we started this project of restoring this old log house. We bought the house from a friend who takes down old log houses. He dropped them all off on the property. The house was from the 1870s, and it had been in Elkhart Lake. It was made mostly of tamarack logs, some oak, hand-hewn. And so then we began this project of putting the logs back together. We had to make some new logs, and it took up, I think it was about two and a half years of building before we actually moved in, and it continues to be an ongoing project. So yeah, that was, and I was right in the thick of it at that time that you wrote that poem.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's a little bit more of what I got from, those details are a little bit more of what I got from Zara too.
Yeah.
So there is a certain beauty in reassembling your own old house. May it stand solid for 100 more years, for Joe Orso. This is how to pray. Think the rings in the logs. Feel their rough and smooth textures under the palm of your hands as you read the wood, the grain. Like one uses fingertips to read Braille. listen to the stories, packed into the whorls, the cells no longer growing. Dip your hands, your feet, your head into the creek. Let its cool stories swirl your hair, your fingerprints into its wetness, braiding together, then fraying apart. Walk to see the sun every day and allow yourself to be astounded as if it were a total solar eclipse you are witnessing, because that light is just as much miracle as that rare dark. It's just its everydayness that can make us take it for granted. Thank your hands for the dance they do when you speak, soft, but there is power there in that quiet. Thank the weeds as you pluck them from garden soil and know that there are plants that seem to follow us everywhere. That plantain is never hard to find, especially when the wasp stings and the green growing medicine is needed.
Mm, thank you. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
I realized I didn't know how to pronounce the word whorl. Do you know how to pronounce that word?
That's funny. When I was reading it this morning, that's kind of why I had you read it instead of me. Because when I read that too, I was like, wait, is that whirl or is it whirl? Like, whor. I had the exact same thought when I came and found that. That's funny.
It's not an everyday vocabulary word, turns out.
Right. Yeah. Talk a little bit about, I mean, we can go in many directions from this, and I would like to talk about home, but I would also like to talk about poetry, and specifically your journey with poetry, starting at the farmer's market, but obviously blossoming out from there. But maybe you could, because that's amazing to me that someone can, that you can sit in the middle of, in a public space with a typewriter, so you can't like cut and paste, and someone comes up to you, tells you a little bit about someone who you've never met, and you can create something like that out of thin air. That's really magical, because it's also really powerful. Like, we didn't put it in a frame because we knew you. We put it in a frame because this thing came, and we were like, wow, that's really meaningful. That building that house was a big part of our journey together, and the way that those words like came together in that poem was like a gift to us that like helped us hold that journey that our family made. Mm. How do you, like, why did you do that? How do you do that?
Let's see. So I guess there's a couple things to say. And I guess technically in the timeline, I started, so there's this poet, Jacqueline Susskind, who also does this type of thing, and she calls it Poem Store. And she started doing it with a friend whose name I can't remember, but I think, well, she sat side by side, typewriter with a friend somewhere public many years ago. And that's where she learned the idea of doing such a thing. She's on the West Coast, or was on the West Coast. She lived in LA. So at some point I met her at an artist residency, and so that idea just kind of lodged itself in me. I am a fan of typewriters and poems and writing and people and their stories. So, and I guess many years before that, I did the same type of thing once at a celebration for an organization called Write Around Portland, in Portland, Oregon, where there were different poets doing poems on the fly for people. So that was the first time I did it, and that was back in 2006 or something like that. And then meeting Jacqueline and being reminded of that experience, and that is a thing that a person can do. And like, Jacqueline actually made her livelihood off of it. And then I was living in at Sandhill, which is an intentional community in Northeast Missouri, in a trifecta of intentional communities there. And another neighboring community was having an open house, and I parked myself on the front porch of the mercantile there and did poems to go there, and that was kind of like my first re-entry into that. And for me, it's so much about, like, sure, a poem comes out of it, but to me, it's so much about what happens in that moment of connecting with the people that order it and getting, just like this chance encounter with random strangers, or maybe not so strangers in the case of Zara ordering this poem for you. But to me, it feels like it's part writing a poem. It's almost like part divination a little bit when the poem comes out, and maybe it speaks to something that people needed to hear, wanted to hear, not always, but and then it's also part, sometimes it's almost like part therapy. I'm someone that people can share something with that maybe they can't share. People have said that, not everyone, but just that, like, oh, I didn't realize I needed to say that, or I don't know, I'm like maybe an easy person for people to share something with if they don't know me, so I'm not in their lives, it feels maybe safer. So it's kind of all those things. And I just really love hearing people's stories. So I love listening to the Moth Radio. Are you familiar with mm-hmm. that? Yeah. And then I also love reading Readers Write in the Sun magazine. Mm-hmm. And I feel like writing these poems for people is a little bit of my own, you know, personal, like, Moth Radio Hour, or my own personal, someone's sharing their Readers Write story with me. And I don't know. I just kind of get in a zone. So anything, you know, I've done this at fairs, farmer's market, so there can be a lot of hubbub around me, but I just kind of, like, zone in. And everything else around me just kind of washes around me. And I don't know. So I'm able to get into a zone.
Yeah. It's cool because it's like there's this, you know, there's, when you're in a public space, there's kind of a, there's a surface that people, like, are all floating on, and you're having certain kinds of conversations that are maybe not as intimate. I mean, they can be intimate mm-hmm. in public spaces, especially at farmers markets, but it's kind of a, you know, it's, there's like a more public way that we relate to each other in those spaces. Mm-hmm. But then to have this vessel, this human being who's writing poetry there and inviting your story, it kind of like immediately pulls people below the surface and draws out meaning and story. That's really, it's really beautiful. And how that then, like, shapes other interactions in the market, I have no idea, but mm-hmm. certainly it must. And I used to have the idea personally of doing a farmer's market stand because I grew up Catholic and doing confessions. like charging minimal fees, either face-to-face or behind the the wall, and then doing a gossip column on the side. But I never pulled that together.
Yeah, the ethics of that are a little questionable.
It's super sketchy. Yeah, no, I was always just, I didn't actually plan on doing that. And no disrespect to the confessional, but I just thought that would be funny. Do you ever think of doing it again? Because it's been some years since you've gone there.
Yeah, I mean, I actually applied to, you know, have a stand at the farmer's market as a drop-in so I can just let the farmer's market people know on Friday, by Friday, that I would like a stand on Saturday. So I intend to do it this season.
Cool.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just like, oh, getting up that early.
Yeah.
To on a weekend. But it's so worth it. And so I just, like, I'm glad that we're revisiting this poem and talking about this because it is so worth it. I think it can be really vulnerable, actually, to just be sitting there waiting for people to engage. For other people out there who are listening who have done vending, I don't know if you have this experience, and I don't know if you, Joe, have had this experience, but just like, it can be pretty exhausting that mm-hmm. interaction. And sometimes that can really fuel people, and sometimes it can, I don't know. So one thing I have noticed about doing the poems at the market that is really interesting is if I'm just sitting there with my typewriter and I'm waiting for someone to come by, and my stand is like nothing fancy. I don't have a tent. It's just like a little table with a little tablecloth on my typewriter and, like, you know, handmade signs. And people walk past and be like, poems to go, and kind of chuckle and be like, cute, or, you know. But then when I'm engaged and the typewriter's going and people see that process happening, I feel like there's a whole different attitude, like, wow, what is that? That's cool. Or there's a different kind of, like, respect or something. Mm-hmm. So the stories and collecting those and the interactions with people while working on the poems are really, like, life-giving to me. And then also just kind of that, you know, sort of sitting there and offering up what I have to offer up and, like, waiting for people to approach. In my mind, that just feels like a really vulnerable place. And maybe it doesn't feel that way when I'm actually there, but I think that also keeps me from, like, I have to work up to it a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know if it's what it feels like to you, but to me, it feels like a very courageous place to inhabit, to go. I mean, for anybody to show up at the farmer's market and to put yourself out there and, like, these are the things that I've made or grown.
Yeah.
You know? But then, especially, like, when you're actively creating the thing in the space, it definitely takes bravery. I mean, I wasn't even brave enough to go up to the table and ask you for a poem.
Well, I think that's another thing. And that's another thing, too. Mm-hmm. You know, some people might entertain the idea. They might circle mm-hmm. around a couple times. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's kind of this mutual, like, we're both kind of putting ourselves out there. So it's really sweet to meet people in that space.
I also love it because the way that it's totally... Well, I don't know if you would say this. I have a feeling that it's very much in opposition to the way that writing is generally finds its way to readers. There's, like, on the far end, there's the publishing industry mm-hmm. that is very, like, you know, big and, you know, with all kinds of systems and marketing departments and all that. And then there's also people doing independent writing, but digitally, mm-hmm. Still, like, kind of related to the faraway world through the internet, which is cool. I mean, but to be doing writing in a physical space with a typewriter for the human being who shows up, it's like the most intimate way to do writing that I can imagine, and is very much almost like opposed to the way that it generally happens. And I really like that aspect of it. I like to think of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's when, I mean, maybe we talked about this in the field once, so I haven't been really actively submitting work to publications for a couple years, maybe. But while I am doing that, you know, I'm basically, a lot of times there's a submission fee, and sometimes it's really minimal, like $3 or something, or depending on what I'm submitting, sometimes it's $25, sometimes it's $50 if it's like a whole collection, and it's submitting it to a prize that is more well-known. You know, in that world, I'm basically often, statistically speaking, paying people to say no to me in my work.
It's so crazy how it works. Yeah. I know, totally.
I mean, I do, you know, I have gotten mm-hmm. some things published that way, but, sure. And then this is like the antithesis of that. It's like people are paying me, and I do a sliding scale. So whatever people want to pay or feel like it's worth. So they're paying me and saying yes. Like every time I write a poem and read it for people, you know, there's just this register in them or in me, this thing that registers where they're just like, it often moves them. It's often like just the thing they needed at that time. So, you know, they pay me and they're saying yes to me. Mm-hmm. And the payment is, you know, like sometime I do barter too. So like a person, you know, I think I was doing a thing in L.A., doing poems in L.A., and a person, like a gospel singer, like sang me a song in exchange for a poem. I was doing poems in the Bay Area. I brought my typewriter with me on some traveling that I was doing. And someone was like, I just made this batch of granola and I happen to have some with me. Like, you know, here's some fresh granola for a fresh poem. So I just like all the possibility in there, and that, yeah, it helps. I have said that it helps me keep doing the other thing too, the submitting and paying money to have people typically say no to me.
Right. How did those two, like, how did they feed you in different ways? Because those are two very different ways of finding readers or sharing your work.
Uh-huh.
And, like, yeah, I'm just curious, as someone who's pursued writing in, like, at different times over mm-hmm. the years, like, how did those two avenues feel different to you?
I mean, I think I would say with Poems to Go, like, I believe in it. And then with kind of like the publishing world, writing industry, I just have a lot more like questions or reservations about what is that, how it works. If I get something published in a thing, is anyone even going to read it? Whose hands is it going to end up in? Where is it going to go? What is it going to do? And with Poems to Go, it's like I know exactly who it's going to. And I've been shown, for me, one of the things that's been really cool about doing this over the years is being shown when poetry is needed or necessary. And so, like, you know, poems for welcoming new life into the world, poems for, you know, people who are grieving someone who has passed on from this world, poems, I don't know, it just shown me, like, when poems are necessary. And those aren't the only two circumstances, you know, poems for someone who just, you know, got a certificate in a program and is moving on to the next big thing, or a poem for, you know, someone who's living with a chronic illness, or, yeah.
Hmm. Oh, got to do a station ID.
Great.
So abrupt. Sorry. You're listening to Conversations here on WDRT Viroqua. Again, I'm your host, Joe Orso, here with my friend Frankie Voltz, and we've been talking about her poetry and, I love hearing that. I've encountered a couple of other writers recently who reach a much more intimate audience mm-hmm. than writers who I'm used to reading.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing like how those are both online, although one of them I know offline as well. And just seeing how that work happens, and it feels so much different than buying these like big name anonymous people from this big name industrial publisher. And the work is really profound and beautiful and meaningful, and it like comes with a community attached to it that is also really, it changes the nature of the work when it's integrated not into kind of like the nameless faraway giant, you know, computer whatever media world,
mm-hmm.
but it inhabits a place and a community, and it has a different power in it, I think. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I really appreciate hearing about you reflect on it.
Do you want to share, like, these other examples?
Yeah, I could actually, I brought one of the poems. So there's a guy named Austin Smith, which some folks around here will know. He was in California. He moved here a year or so ago and lived in this area for a short while, and then he moved back to California where he teaches poetry. But he just does like a poem a day Substack page.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got to know him, not really through his poetry, but just like as a human. And then we were talking, and he was, you know, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna read his stuff. And it's like, wow, I love his stuff. So I'll read one that came through the other day. Is that okay? Yeah, I can do that. It's called Keening Kennings. We who are cellar sheltered summon you, lightning limbed centaur, born west of wherever we are. Ground surrounded, we hear you, but don't fear you. Come lumbering toward us, grumbling your thundery brogue, armed with farm machinery. But be sure you fling winged singers ahead of you, harbingers of the damage you intend, so we know you are close and can prepare our hearts for you. Barn burner, pardon ours. Alight lightly on rod, or sink your lord sword into sod, or if you just must choose a witness tree, an oak to cloak in flame, so we know when we surface, sail pale where you've tread. So yeah, so he's you know, sharing this with like a community. I don't know all the people in his community, but I know like our connection, and I know some other people in the community. And I just like, when I get that poem a day directly from him, I kind of feel like all these other people receiving this, wondering about it. Yeah, and the other is a guy who I just found on Substack, who's just doing everything independently, not connected. He has a Substack called Sabbath Empire. I'm really newly encountering it in the last like few weeks, and he self-published a book that you can find like very reasonably through his, you know, web presence, and I ordered that, and it was like amazing and really beautiful. He lives in Minnesota. And so it's just like, yeah, it feels different than most of the writers who I generally read, because there's like something smaller about it all, and more like, I feel like I could email him, or I know I could, and have conversations, you know. So you probably know all kinds of people like that, probably a lot more than I do, because you've been in the writing world, maybe more integrated into it.
Some, yeah, and I know I'd have a similar feeling, like, oh, when I get I don't know, I'll just say a missive, you know, from a writer who's sending to their subscribing people, that I have a similar feeling, like, oh, I, you know, can imagine other people who are friends or connected to this person reading this work, and a lot of times it is... yeah, maybe it feels like it fulfills some of that personal storytelling stuff that I'm really interested in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, I think it's both and, not either or. Like, that's why I like to do the poems to go, but then when I am actively submitting and trying to engage in that other world too, like, I think that they support each other. They help keep each other going. But I think my mode is always kind of like, you know, do it yourself, or like by the people for the people. So that's always like more interesting to me. But then maybe has a smaller audience. I'm not really sure. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. There can be like they can complement each other.
But I don't, I definitely like fight with myself less when I'm doing poems to go. Like, that's kind of my element, you know, I'm just like riding the wave. But then when I'm like looking at calls for submissions, and I'm just like thinking about the whole industry and how it's constructed, and like, am I writing, you know, who am I writing for? Is my writing valued? Is it going to be, you know, so like, am I giving them what they want? Is this going to be giving them what they want?
Right.
And I just don't have those questions when I do poems to go.
Right.
It's so much more gratifying.
Yeah. Cool. Do you want to read another poem? You brought some poems.
Sure. Yeah. So I have three poems. We probably won't get to all of them in this conversation, but I did just notice that two of them, well, they all deal with the natural world in a certain way, but I guess maybe this is the one that I come back to over and over again, and the author is Ross Gay, who has several books out, and one is like, oh, what is it? There's one called The Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, which I haven't read. But then there's also The Book of Delights, I think, is, and it's just, it's wonderful. I highly recommend it. And it's not poems. It's kind of like poetic, short, very short essays. But this poem by Ross Gay is called A Small Needful Fact. And it mentions Eric Garner in the first line. And Eric was killed in a prohibited chokehold by police in New York City on Staten Island. And said, I can't breathe, like 11 times before he was killed, before he died because of that chokehold. So this is A Small Needful Fact by Ross Gay. A small needful fact is that Eric Garner worked for some time for the Parks and Rec Horticultural Department, which means, perhaps, that with his very large hands, perhaps in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants which, most likely, some of them, in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe.
I love it.
Yeah.
I just feel like I'm supposed to, like, when you encounter poetry or art, and I'm like, okay, well,
we can just let it be too.
I know, and I think that's like the best approach is just to wonder at it. Uh-huh. But on the radio, it's hard to, like, you guys right. Say something.
We're wondering right now, in case you're wondering what's happening here. But I do love with that piece that he's taking something that's he's taking an event that a lot of eyes were on, and that is has a lot of feelings around it for a lot of people in very strong ways, and looking at these really small elements, looking at this small possibility and making this connection between tending to plants and breathing, and also kind of a nod to Eric Garner's spirit still being alive through these plants in this way on the earth. That's my take on it.
It's I love it, because there's, you know, anything that, any event that rises up to the media sphere, you know, it's like there's these painful events that happen somewhere in reality, and then they like just get like increasingly toxified as they rise up into the political sphere and media sphere and the conversations that happen around it, I feel like. And that poem like just goes down underneath all of it and brings you towards this person's human and spiritual existence.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like very, it like disarms all of that toxicity. Mm-hmm. It's not like, anything. Yeah, it's just, I appreciate that. So, Frankie and I, there's an alarm going off somewhere outside this room.
Hopefully there's not a tornado
heading
our way.
We'll just ignore it. If you hear us screaming and running, it's just because something's happening. We've spent most of our time conversating on the farm, weeding things, harvesting things, washing things. I was thinking about bringing in a couple of hand hoes so we could weed this studio space today.
Which it looks like it could use a little.
Right. Yeah.
Got to see some lamb's quarters coming up, and
yeah, definitely. What is your favorite farm tool? Thank
you. Well, okay. This is so I have a digging fork, actually tattooed on the back of one of my legs.
Oh,
yeah. Tattooed by my farm mate when I lived in Missouri. Like, she... So this is interesting because we don't... Like, at Small Family Farm, this is not a tool we ever use there. But I first used it at... So I don't... I'm not a favorites kind of person. So yeah. I like different tools for different things. And I think actually my favorite farm tool is a well-kept farm tool. So if it has a blade, it's sharp. It gets cleaned after it's used so it doesn't rust. If a handle's broken, the handle's been fixed. So like a well-tended to farm tool, I think, is my favorite farm tool. But yeah, I really came to like the digging fork, I think, on the first farm that I ever worked on. I was an apprentice. Well, it's not the first. Anyway, I was an apprentice on an organic farm in Portland, Oregon. And the apprentices were like getting, we were, you know, doing the work on the CSA farm. It was an organic CSA veggie farm. So we were doing that work, but we were kind of getting lessons throughout the season as well, like doing readings, talking about stuff related to growing food. And we did in one of the greenhouses like a John Jevons double digging. So it's like hand kind of turning the soil without machinery. And so I think that was like my first encounter with the digging fork. And one of the things that, like, in this specific method of using the digging fork, which if you don't know what a digging fork is, it's not a pitchfork like in the American Gothic. It doesn't have the tall handle with the skinny tines. Like, that's good for moving mulch around and stuff. A digging fork has a shorter handle, and the forks are thick. And so you can really dig into the earth and turn and move. But this very specific method, this John Jevons method of doing the double digging with a digging fork, were we even, we might even been using shovels, so this story might be moot, but.
Oh, let's just say digging fork.
The point is, I learned some body mechanics that I can use with a digging fork, which is like a way to not wreck your body, which I think is also partly why I like the well-tended tools, because if the tool is in good shape, then I think it is less wear and tear on your body. But you can basically put your full weight onto the fork. If you can get up, you know, get it into the earth a little bit, balance yourself on it, and kind of stand and rock yourself back and forth while you're on the fork. Similar to a broad fork, I don't know if you've ever used. Like, I just love that it, you're using your own body weight without wrecking your body.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just using a broad fork yesterday, and my son, Wendell, who's six, he's like, how do you get it to go into the ground? Because he was trying to, but you know, he's six.
Yeah.
I was like, I just grew. I have some more weight, Wendell. You'll be able to do that at some point too. He's like, I just keep jumping on it. I can't make it go in. He was doing it on the path, not in the bed. I really like that answer, because I was also thinking over the past several days, looking at my tools, how not well-tended they are. Like, my digging fork, you know, that, like, wooden dowel over at the top of the handle or whatever it is, it's, like, all cracking and about to come off, and my broad fork handles are also cracking and spiral splitting. And I've been thinking about how my dad used to really care for his tools. He would oil them, and he would just like keep them very nice. If he borrowed a neighbor's tool, he would always like tend it very well and return it, you know, beautiful.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, as I was looking at my own tools the other day, I was like, gosh, it is so hard to tend to things well. Like, that's what I want to do with all of my life, is just be present with the thing that I'm doing, take care of, like, the tools, take care of the garden, take care of the building, tend the children, give attention to where I am, who I'm with, and what I'm using. Like, it feels like that is almost like the highest spiritual goal that, that I have or something.
Yeah.
Maybe not that, but it's something in there. And But I find that very difficult to do. Usually, whatever I'm doing, I'm just like trying to blaze through it as fast as possible so I can get to the other thing that right. I'm not doing things in my mind uh-huh. as opposed to doing the thing I'm doing.
Right.
And I feel like that well-kept tool is a sign of someone who's attentive to the task at hand, which is the culture doesn't really, I don't do that. And mm-hmm. I feel like it's not culturally normal to be like that. Mm-hmm. But I like it.
Are you calling me culturally abnormal?
You keep your tools well? Are yours oiled?
I don't oil them, but I noted that. I was like, okay, that's the next. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have a wire brush, so I try to mm-hmm. clean them after every use. And mm-hmm. and some of this is just what I've learned at other places I've
yeah.
been at. And I love a sharp tool. Like mm-hmm. if it has a blade, I love. So,
oh, yeah.
My partner, Jennifer, and I, we scythe our yard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We live in town, so we're like the weird people on the block. Mow the lawn by scything it. And I feel like half of the work of scything is just keeping that blade sharp. You mm-hmm. know, like supposedly for every 100 strokes, you should be sharpening the blade.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
You don't have a lawnmower?
No. Well, we do have like a manual push mower.
But you scythe.
Yeah.
How long do you let the grass get before you scythe? I mean, can you do it? Can you keep it relatively short, scything a yard?
Yeah. Yeah. You can. I mean, and we actually did the no mow May this year and then scythed. And so that was like the first very tall stuff we ever scythed. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. And typically, like, that's what one would be doing if they were in the field, is scything very tall.
Mm-hmm.
And then the weight of the plant actually like helps it fall down and do the thing you're trying to do, which is to cut it down. But it was almost like twice as much work because some of what we were cutting through was like dandelion, which is really thick. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's mowing a lawn that's not super tall is maybe not as pleasing perhaps as mowing a tall field of all the same plant that you're cutting down, but yeah, it's just good to like make sure that it's damp, so you do it early in the morning if you can.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it helps a lot. So, yeah. I don't know.
I'm going to do another station ID here.
Okay.
You're listening to Conversations here on WDRT Viroqua. What else?
Well, I just love that, you know, thinking about the tending and how that brings you back to your dad and just the ways that we can sort of, like, carry other people's spirits by, like, if you were to start putting more attention onto tool tending and, like, that's a way of, I don't know how you see it, but
no, definitely.
To me, like, that's a way of, like, being with him or having him be with you.
Yeah, definitely. No, that very thought has been like what's helped move me kind of towards some of this, just like looking at the handles and thinking of dad's shovels.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, I want to be like that. And not, you know, not just out of like shame and guilt and like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Just all over the place. But like, that's a beautiful like model to follow. And it's like the way that I want to be around tools and the way that I want my kids to be around tools and around each other and around like the land.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is like very much integrated with the, you know, with the spirit of dad.
Mm-hmm.
It carries him in it. So, yeah.
Do you have a favorite farm tool?
Oh, I should have thought of that. So we were talking about that, and I don't have any tattooed.
then you obviously don't.
Yeah. What came to mind for me when you were talking about that was yesterday, which is wrapped up with what we've been talking about. So I was working in the garden yesterday, planting carrots, and Wendell came into the garden with me, checking in, and he was just hanging out and chatting, asking me to tell stories and telling his own stories, and I said, "Do you want to plant, you know, seeds with me, Wendell?" And he's like, "Sure." And I should say, I have a, this is like a confession. I have a tendency to
oh,
be.
We got the confession booth going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, that's perfect. I have a tendency to be like a little systematic and like tight about doing things the right ways, which is one of the things I navigate working with kids or my kids, because there's, you know, because there's learning. Like, I would not be a good teacher. Because, you know, there's like room for allowing the learning process to happen in a really safe and like loving way, to do it imperfectly. And so I'm always coming up against my own neuroses in that way. But when I invited Wendell to plant carrot seeds with me, I'm like, the main thing here is not the carrot seeds. It's like the young boy planting the carrot seeds.
Yeah.
It's like that whole thing. And so we were, you know, making, or I would make the little, you know, line in the soil and then, you know, just show him how to do it. And just like watching his little, what I loved watching, so this is my favorite garden tool, is Wendell's fingers. And just like watching, so I kind of do it and, you know, like you're trying to be efficient and fast and I'm kind of sprinkling them as I go. And then he would get some, and he would just pick up like one seed and like then like grab the one seed from his finger and set it in the soil. And then he would grab another seed and set it in the soil. And I was like, "You can like try this sprinkle thing if you want." And he kind of looked at me and then just kept grabbing one seed and setting it in the soil. And boy, it like calmed my heart so much just to watch him do it and just to be like, ugh. I can be attentive. I'm not totally crazy. And it was just like so lovely. And then we would like plant seeds working, you know, towards each other from two ends. And then it's like, okay, you know, you got it now. And you can go do that line. I'm going to go over here and do this line. And it was so lovely. I loved it.
And so just like
watching his little fingers do the work. And to just do it so gently and with such attention, it really fed me. And so anyway, that would be, yeah, that would be my answer.
I love it.
Yeah. What else do you want to talk about?
Well, it's interesting you bring up the neuroses because, you know, I feel like a flip side to thinking about the tool tending is like, oh, well, if you're someone who shares tools with me or shares a garden with me, like, I feel like there's a flip side to the tool tending, like how to cultivate that with people that you're sharing those tools with in a way that doesn't feel micromanage-y. Because maybe, like you, with planting and garden, like, I'm very systematic with not just tools. And so that's a thing that when sharing a home, whether it's with a partner, whether it's with a whole community, that's been a thing. Like, how to navigate that balance of, like, having these ideas about tending to our tools, to our spaces, to, you know, the things that we use in the kitchen in the day-to-day and keeping them well and keeping them spaces usable. Yeah, there's, like, this fine line between, like, sure, maybe that sounds like the highest, you know, spiritual, I don't remember how you said that, but then it's also, like, can be this really contested thing when it comes to sharing those spaces, those tools, those practices with other people, like how to navigate that.
Yeah, totally.
So when you have that, I mean, just, I'll just think of Wendell's fingers and the seed by seed.
Right.
And use that as my guide as I'm trying to figure out how to, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any insights about how you navigate that boundary? Because that is, yeah, it's like we have our own ways that we're trying to be, and then there's all these people, you know, don't get it. No, I'm just kidding. Obviously.
Well, I don't know.
But I know. Yeah, I mean that's like the complexity of community, yeah. Especially as it gets more and more intimate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that's really stood out for me, and I'm not sure how to necessarily incorporate this, but my friend A.M. Has a son, Max, who's maybe 5 or 6 now, and her husband, partner, Grant, and we talk back and forth a lot, and I just feel like I really taken to heart when she said, we're two different people, we parent differently. And I haven't navigated, you know, parenting with another person. I don't have kids and I haven't parented other people's kids really, except for maybe when I lived at the community a little bit. I was like a very close aunt, but not a parent. Mm-hmm. And I try to remember that and try to balance like, oh, you know, we do these things differently. So we have different systems, whether it's parenting or, and it might not be easy to watch the other person parent in a different way or do the other, I don't know. So I took that seed and I buried it in me somewhere because it feels like really useful information that can be applied to a lot of stuff. And I'm still trying to figure out how to actually apply it mm-hmm. to a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it feels like that's the path toward generosity. It's just like there's a very different way of being here, you know, in this person and in me, mm-hmm. And like accepting it and then just trying to tend to your own way in as you can. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could read another poem.
I think that would be fun.
Okay.
I was thinking the same thing.
So this one, I'm not familiar with this author, but I came across this poem. The author's name is David Baker, and I came across this poem in an anthology called Ghost Fishing, which is it's like an eco-poetic anthology, so a lot of work dealing with human nature connection. And I wish that the listeners could see how this is laid out on the page because it's very interesting, but you can't. So if you can find it, it's called Too Many by David Baker. Too many, my neighbors say, when what they mean are deer, the foragers, the few at a time, fair if little more than rats, according to a farmer friend nearby whose corn means plenty. They nip the peaches and one bite ruins. Hazard every road with their running into headlights, not away. A menace, plague, something should be done. Or here in town, where I've found a kind of afterlife, the townies hate the damage to their variegated hostas, shadeside ferns. What they do inside white bunkers of the country's one good course is criminal. Deep scuffs through the sand, that's one thing. But lush piles of polished olive droppings, hoof ruts in the chemically and color enriched greens. Yet here's one more, curled, like a tan seashell, not a foot from my blade, just come to the world, fawn, speckled, wet as trout, which I didn't see hacking back brush beneath my tulip poplar. It's not afraid, mews like a kitten, can't walk. There are so many, too many of us, the world keeps saying, and the world keeps making. This makes no sense more. And I think my personal connection to this piece is my partner and I have community garden plots right behind our house. There's a community garden. And there's also what we call the little woods. So it's like just this little patch of sort of wild woods. And there are deer that bed down there sometimes. And then they also hang out in the park here in town, in the little woods in the park. And then we call it the bed and breakfast. So they wake up and munch on people's gardens. But our first year in this house in town, on Mother's Day, there was a fawn curled up right next to, in our yard, in our backyard, right next to our garage for the whole day. And it's just this balance of like, this notion of humans saying, there's too many deer. Like, you know, they're a nuisance, they're a bother. And just working with that. Like, if you want to grow food and you don't want the deer, then build a fence or like find ways to defend your food. But what we share this place. And in reality, there's like so many humans. There's too many humans, one could say, you know, eating away at the habitat of all the other beings. So when there's this interplay between humans and animals that maybe humans find nuisance-like, I don't know. These are things that I think about sometimes, like that loss of habitat for other beings. And then to me, when I get to have these interactions with animals, no matter how much of a nuisance, it's like makes something come alive in me. Like there's a baby, a young skunk, not a baby skunk, in our garden the other day when I was planting. We were like 10 feet from each other, me and this skunk, and the skunk was like digging around in all this mulch I put down, going into the holes where I had planted tomatoes. I see those deer too munching away, and I don't know. It's just like I still have this awe and this wonder, and it's just interesting, the human relationships and interactions with other animals. And
yeah, I mean, it feels like one of the things that our culture does is it makes us really blind to like the particular beings that we live among, including the particular humans. Somehow it just makes us really we're populations as opposed to sacred beings. Like I think of when I was listening to that, I was thinking of just like how roadkill, you know, we drive by it all the time and don't even, I mean, like I don't even think twice sometimes. It's just like, oh, this disgusting thing to swerve around. And actually like, oh, that was like a living being who suffered a really traumatic ending to their life. And you know, deer are kind of the same way. You just see, you know, they're so plentiful that we can't see them, and because we're not like integrated with them, or we're integrated with them in like very particular ways, we miss kind of their presence. So yeah, I love how that, and it's like in a similar way that the Eric Garner poem like brought just like the intimacy of that person to life. I really appreciate that. We've been battling a red-winged blackbird. We have a walk down to our creek right now. And yeah, he attacks us almost every time.
Like what? Comes down at your head from above?
Yeah, it comes down. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have had
squawk,
that experience.
Squawk, get out of here. This is my...
Totally. But this is like our one path mode to the creek that we go down all the time. And so every time now it's highly stressful. Wendell does have a toy stop sign that we hold up on a stick. And the bird seems to respond to it kind of well. Or
like the bird's reading the sign, or just
that's what it feels like. Or I just think it's like a tall thing that's bright red that maybe gives the bird some pause. Or it could be reading it. I don't totally know. So we do that. Or I also walk down sometimes and just like, you know, shake my hands above my head. Which I'm always like wondering how that looks to cars back. driving by. But it's not, I also like that our whole family has this, you know, we talk a lot about this papa bird, and know where his nest is, and we see the mama come around too. And anyway, we have 30 seconds.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
We have a little more. Is there anything that you want to end with, or anything you want to,
I have another super short poem. I think this feels like a good ending. If you feel...
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is called Blessing the Boats by Lucille Clifton. May the tide that is entering even now the lip of our understanding carry you out beyond the face of fear. May you kiss the wind, then turn from it, certain that it will love your back. May you open your eyes to water, water waving forever, and may you and your innocence sail through this to that.
Thanks, Frankie.
Thanks for conversating.
Yeah. Do you have a website you want to?
Oh, I do.
People to?
Yeah. It's my name, FrancisCikaVoeltz.com.
Yeah.
So good luck with that.
You can find Frankie's writing and other things there.
Yeah. So. And I hope to appear at the farmer's market sometime soon, too. So
be brave.
Yeah, be brave.
All right. Well, you have been listening to Conversations here on WDRT Viroqua. Thanks for joining us, Frankie, and thanks for joining us, all you who are listening out there.